Squeeze in there. All right, happy Hanukkah, everybody. Night number 7. Did you order a book? I think we have, Karen ordered one. You didn't? Is that yours?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So I think we've got we may have an extra one here. But I actually don't need it right now, so if anybody wants to follow along, although we're not going to do much in text here. So night number 7 of Hanukkah, candles are burning. The true light of Hanukkah is the light of Torah. Ki ner mitzvah v'Torah or. It says Torah is light. So we're going to study some Torah tonight. We're beginning the actual text of the book of Joshua, chapter 1 and 2. How many of you have had taken the time to read it? Awesome. Fantastic. Good. A little bit. Good. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with... There she is. You have one of these books, right?
Yes, I told Rabbi Ari, he said that y'all had ordered enough of them.
There you go.
And you got a deal beyond deals, right?
The deal of all deals.
I know.
So grab that one for you, and you're welcome to...
It's unbalanced over here.
Yeah, please balance it out. Take some notes. Thank you.
Yes,
as I said, just squeeze yourself in there. Just push people over to get in.
I feel like it needs to be balanced. It's my obsessive compulsiveness.
Thank you. We appreciate you doing that. Okay, so last time we gave an intro to the book of Joshua, intro to prophets in general, and specifically to the book of Joshua. Did anybody have any specific questions before we jump in? My game plan today is to review, kind of summarize chapter 1, go a little bit in depth into chapter 1, summarize chapter 2, and go in depth into a couple of items in chapter 2. Although the book of Joshua has quite a number of chapters, at least a third of it is not something we're going to study together. Because, I shouldn't say this on tape, it's quite boring. There's not much to study. That's not really true. It's not much for me to study with you, because it's mostly just a constant recounting of the battles and the division of land, which takes up most of the end of the book of Joshua. And I'm sure there's in-depth to look at the various different maps and understand the battles. But most of the good meat is in the first half of the book, the first two-thirds, and that's what we're going to focus on. Any comments, questions before we jump in? Okay. Five books of Moses ends with the passing of Moses. There's a little period of time between the passing of Moses and when Joshua begins to act out his leadership. And we're going to talk about that a little bit in depth in a little bit. God communicates with Joshua and gives him instruction. He gives him his marching orders, reminding him that it's all about strength, inner character, which stems from a belief in God and a relationship with God, observance of the mitzvot. And as long as he will follow through that, then ultimately the land of Israel, with its boundaries that God promised to Moses and to the Jewish people, will be inherited by the people. Which is one reason why, as we'll discuss next week, one of the first battles that they fought after the Battle of Jericho, the Battle of Ai, a number of Jews were killed. And it ultimately was because they disobeyed God's word. And it was a vivid manifestation of God's instruction to Joshua and to the Jewish people that as long as they follow God's word, things are going to go swell. As soon as they break from that, the consequences will be quick to come. God instructs Joshua, and this is an important point because it's going to recur in one of the coming chapters. God instructs him to make sure that he's constantly studying Torah, that his preoccupation, other than leading the people, needs to be in the study of Torah. And we're going to find an encounter that he has with an angel that was on account of perhaps Joshua slacking off on his study of Torah. So that's the opening of the chapter. Then Joshua gives instruction to the Shotrim. Shotrim are officers, and he gives them instruction to pass between the people and to prepare themselves for in 3 days they're destined to cross over the Jordan River. He instructs them to prepare themselves. And the preparation is both a physical preparation and a spiritual preparation. Physical preparation is make sure you're ready to travel. You have your arms together. You have your food together. I'm not necessarily food, because we're going to talk about that, what happened with the food a little later. But to make sure that they are spiritually focused on what they're about to do. Then we watch how Joshua brings together the tribe of Reuven, the tribe of Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, and reminds them of their promise, which we're going to elaborate on later, but their promise that they made to go in front of the Jewish people, to lead the Jewish people in battle, and only once they are victorious in battle will they return back to the other side of the Jordan, where they had been promised, they had requested and been promised land. And their response, which is quite telling, is, yes, we're going to do as we promised. And, however, there is an interesting verse they say here. As fully as we listen to Moses, so shall we listen to you. This is a little Bible kind of language, Old English. Oh, that Hashem your God be with you as he had been with Moses. In other words, they're saying to him, we're going to do what we need to do. But God should be with you like he was with Moses. If God is with you like he was with Moses, we're all good. If for whatever reason it doesn't work out that way, look, we make a promise, we're going to follow through. It's good if all of us are in the same line. That's essentially what they're saying. And that closes out chapter 1. So I printed out for you on the second page here. I didn't intentionally do it sloppy, but I intentionally only included the important part because I don't want you to be distracted by the other details there right now. So let's put this in context just so we could understand the sequence. The rule is that when we mourn a leader, there is a 30-day mourning period. In general, in Jewish practice, we have Shiva, the 7 days of mourning, then you have what's known as Shloshim, 30 days of mourning. When a person's parent passes, they have a year of mourning. When a child, God forbid, passes, there's a 30-day mourning period. It doesn't have the same severity as a year of mourning. And if I'm not mistaken, that is the case as well when a sibling passes. And if I'm not mistaken, when a spouse passes. I think other than a parent, the mourning period is only a 30-day mourning period, if I'm not mistaken. I think I'm correct on that. Moses, being a leader of the people, obviously evoked a mourning period of 30 days. Moses, according to our tradition, was born and passed away on the 7th day of the month of Adar. Adar is the month that is the month in which Purim occurs. And as the story goes about the story of Purim, when Haman drew the lot, he said, this is a good month because Moses died in this month. He said, yes, but he was also born in this month. He didn't know that part of it. And also the death of a tzaddik, a death of a righteous person, is actually a blessing for the world. But nonetheless, we know that Moses died on the 7th of Adar. So the 30-day mourning period ends 1 month later, on the 7th of Nisan. So Joshua, as being a leader of the people, did not begin to, so to speak, activate his public role as a leader until after the 30-day period ended. That makes sense. It's not appropriate, right? Not to use a crass term, but the body's still warm, right? It's not appropriate. It's disrespectful. Let the mourning finish, and then it'll be time to move on. Interesting story. One of the great, there are many great Hasidic works. Within the yeshiva system, there are certain years of certain rebbes that are studied more intensely because the teachings of those years are much more intense. In general, much of the teaching that we learn in yeshiva is from the last three Rebbes. So the fifth Rebbe, the Rebbe Rashab, in the year 1906, in Hebrew, Tafresh Samach Vav, delivered a year-long series of discourses. And remember, 1906 in Russia was a hectic time, which merged into the years of communism, and the Chabad movement was running and hiding and leaving, and then dealing with World War I and World War II. So it was many years later, when they came to the United States in 1950, when the Rebbe was appointed as the head of the Kahas Publication Society by his father-in-law. The Rebbe had three main jobs within the Chabad movement. One of them was in charge of the publishing house. So the Rebbe set about to have this series of discourses properly published. They were in handouts, and different people had their version of photocopy back then, but it was time to publish it properly. Now, my grandfather of blessed memory was a printer, and the early Chabad books were printed by his printing press, known as Balshan Printing. In fact, not only Chabad, but many books that were printed in that era were printed by my grandfather. So if you ever see an old book and you open up the cover, the Balshan Printing House was my grandfather's printing house, and I remember always him having black hands from the ink with the... We used to go visit him in his press there. Anyway, so he was in the middle of working on publishing this series of discourses when the previous Rebbe passed away. The morning of the previous Rebbe's funeral, the previous Rebbe passed away on a Shabbos, so Sunday morning, the Rebbe was coordinating the details of the funeral, and the Rebbe saw my grandfather standing in front of 770, in front of the synagogue. The Rebbe turned to my grandfather and he said to him, "Stop the presses. Now is not a time to print." And at the conclusion of the Shiva for the previous Rebbe, when the 7 days had passed, the Rebbe instructed my grandfather. He said, in Yiddish, it's Zeit zu gehen weiter. It's time to move on. It's time to move forward. And this is the same concept. When there's a time of mourning, it's a time to put certain things on hold. Definitely something that's so public as assuming leadership, even though, as we discussed, that baton had been passed, still time to put that aside. And thus, Joshua maintained a low profile until the 7th of Nisan. However, one thing happened, according to some opinions, right before the end of the morning. It's deduced from the different verses, and that is what we're going to read about in chapter 2, the sending of the spies, sending of the two spies. And that was for a practical reason. The spies needed to go. They needed to come back before the Jewish people left. That takes some time. So even though the Jewish people were intended to go into the land on the 10th of Nisan, they needed some time to have the spies go and come back. So Joshua quietly sent the spies, as we're going to discuss at length a little bit more, also why it was done quietly. So the 7th of Nisan is the end of the mourning period, and on the day after, the 8th of Nisan, Joshua instructs the officers to go and tell the people, as we just discussed, to go and prepare themselves for the crossing into the land of Israel. And so on the 8th of Nisan, the marshals tell the people. On the 9th of Nisan, Joshua himself tells the people, which we're going to learn in chapter 3. And then on the 10th of Nisan, they actually come into the land. And as we'll learn further, they circumcise themselves. They offer the Passover sacrifice for the first time since they had left Egypt. And they prepare themselves to wage battle with Jericho. Understanding the 2.5 tribes. So the 2.5 tribes, Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, they were abundant in cattle. And they came to Moses and they said, "There's a lot of land here. And we would like to have our inheritance over here so that we can accommodate our cattle." I don't know if they said "and women and children" or "cattle and children," but they put cattle first. And as we see in the instruction from Joshua to them, he switches the order and puts the women and children before the cattle. Which we can look at this in a couple of ways. But let's first understand on a basic level. On a basic level, they were blessed with great wealth, and they wanted to accommodate their wealth. And there's nothing wrong with that. God gives you wealth. It's for a reason. It's not to be shunned. It's not to be disregarded. It's a responsibility. And therefore, they said, we have a responsibility to this wealth. We need to tend to our animals. So Moses' rebuke to them was first about their priorities. Ideally, God tells you to go into the land of Israel. Don't worry about it. God will find a way to accommodate your wealth in the land of Israel. In other words, don't put the chicken before, you know, the chicken before the egg, or the horse before the... No, you do put... Whatever it is. You don't put the cart before the horse, right? Don't put the cart before the horse. God tells you... God gave you the wealth. God tells you to go into the land of Israel. Go in there and God will figure it out for you. But since you asked, okay, just get your priorities in order. God's going to accommodate you. Now, there's a lot of discussion about what was going on here. One of the most fascinating ideas is that their intention actually was quite noble. Their intention was as follows. They knew that Moses was going to die outside of the land of Israel. He wasn't going to enter the land of Israel. And he was going to be buried on a mountain outside of the land of Israel, overlooking the land of Israel. And they said, we don't want Moses to be lonely. But they couldn't have come out and said that. Because they said, Moses, we don't want you to be here alone. Moses said, you know, I'll take care of myself. Go ahead. So they didn't do that. So they created this other reason to petition for their right to stay on that side of the Jordan. And their petition was granted. But it came with a responsibility. You can't just take your land there and say, you know, Zygazun to everybody else. That's not fair. Not only is it not fair, you're going to weaken the hearts. You're going to melt the hearts of the people who are going to go in. They say, whoa, these guys get their land here. You know, we also want to do that. Right? Why should they not have to go to battle? We're going to go and risk our lives, and they're going to sit happy here and, you know, outside of the land. So they immediately reassured Moses that they had no intention of abandoning the people, and that their intention was to go into the land in front of the people, armed, and only once the people settled the land and divided the land were they going to return to regain their inheritance. And that's exactly what happened. And here we're reading about Joshua reminding them of their oath and they accepting that and affirming it. So both lessons are relevant, both in relation to the relationship that they had with their teacher, with Moses, which we can draw lessons from, and also the message regarding wealth, even if maybe they should have had more faith, but the idea that the possessions, the gifts that God gives us, are our responsibility to nurture and not to discard or shun, but to use it out in our service of God as best as we can. Questions or comments about anything I shared or anything else in chapter 1? Yes?
Two things. First of all, it's kind of an interesting parallel that could be a real launching point for discussion, probably too broad for this right now, but the fact that the three tribes, 2.5 tribes, were relegated and made an oath to go and fight for the land, even if you want to live outside of the land, hypothetically could be drawn as a comparison between diasporic Jews and Jews that live in Israel.
Yes.
Because we are out here making all these judgments and what this they should do here and what Israel should do there, but we're not putting our sons and daughters on the line, right? So it's kind of an interesting...
I thought you were going somewhere else.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I thought you were saying the following, that even though we don't live in Israel,
yeah.
Number one, we have to be invested in Israel.
Yes, well, that's true. That's true.
But that it is our land. And just because we don't live there, it's still our land. Now, we may not demonstrate the same level of responsibility that they did.
Yes.
But that was the message to them, is that, fine, you can be a diaspora Jew, but you got to do your part. You got to be invested in your brothers and sisters in Israel.
And I guess the investment with the question, or where I went a little bit further than that, was to talk about military servitude. So
right.
You know,
but, yeah.
So that's but in essence, everything that you said was embodied in what I was also trying to say, is that there is this investment in the land, and that the land is ours. And then I just took it one.
Yeah, and I like your point, and I'm gonna add another dimension to it, because I want to, at least the perspective I think that the Rebbe had about military responsibility for Jews in the diaspora and even Jews in Israel.
Yeah.
And I'm not getting into the politics of it, but there was a fundamental agreement made when the state was established, because there was an understanding that Israel is Eretz Yisrael, it's the land of Israel, it's not just the state of Israel. And that the land of Israel is a holy land, and it requires both. It requires people to study Torah. It requires people to go to battle. And there's nobody that's going to question, I hope not, that the people that put their physical lives at risk are the greater heroes. But not any less integral are the people that are studying Torah. If we look at what happened there, the women and children stayed back, and some men stayed back on the other side of Jordan. They actually didn't even go in with the rest of the Jews. Not even sitting with them, you know, hanging out behind the lines. They didn't even go in. Did they not have a part in the land of Israel because they stayed behind? No. Their husbands went into the land of Israel. Their sons went into the land of Israel. And regardless, if you want to see that just as their sacrifice, but they are the extension of them. So the people that live in the land of Israel are part of the body of the Jewish people. And frankly, we have a responsibility in the diaspora. And if we didn't, we don't belong here, right? We do belong in Israel. And we're only here because we have responsibilities here. And at the right time, we'll wrap it up and we'll all move to Israel. May it be speedily in our days. But that's the fundamental reality, is that this is not our place. Our place is there. So we have a right to an opinion, right? Yes, plenty of people take that responsibility and go put on a gun. Many people go to Israel and study Torah. But each of us make up the Jewish people and do our role within the context of the Jewish people, each according to, hopefully, according to the talents and responsibility that we've been given.
So yeah, and I like that. The other question that I had was just more of a technical question.
Yeah.
I didn't have this book when I read it, and I had a ridiculous amount, and it uses a little bit different wording, but there is the repetition of be strong and courageous, and it starts, I guess, where does it say it the first time?
6 and 7.
Yeah, and then there's, and then it says it again in 18. At the end, be strong and courageous. And so I just thought that there, you know, of course nothing, things are repeated for a reason. I mean, obviously the simple explanation is, of course, you need to be strong and courageous, but it's repeated twice, at least in my version. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, here it is on 9, be strong and courageous. And then here it is again on 18, be strong and courageous.
So I'll give you the easiest explanation for this. The easiest explanation is that in verse 6, it's a command.
Yes.
Number 7, it's kind of a statement of instruction. So in number 6, God is telling him, strengthen yourself and persevere. Like we say at the end of the, when we conclude the reading of a book of the Torah, we pronounce chazak, chazak, v'nischazek. It's like an instruction. Be strong, be strong. You're going out to war. You know, it's like the coach. Get your act, you know, get ready. We're going to knock them down. We're going to win this war. Right? That's the first one. It's an instruction. The second one is kind of it's more soft. Remember we used that term before, oh, and that's how he translates it. Oh, that you will strengthen yourself. It's almost like a prayer. If you strengthen yourself, and it's a hard word to translate in Yiddish/Hebrew, there's a word halavai. You ever hear that expression? Halavai. It's like, halavai, if you'll only be strong and be strengthened, you'll be successful. So one is an instruction and one is more like a prayer almost. That's the easiest explanation. All right. So that brings it. Yes?
Wait, just one thing.
Yeah.
I thought I heard you mention circumcision. Can you say that again?
We're gonna read about that in the subsequent chapters. It's not in the first two chapters. The Jewish people didn't circumcise themselves while they were in the desert. One of the reasons is it's dangerous. You're traveling in a hot, sandy area, and it's not safe. So even though they were protected by miracles, but you don't put your life at risk when you're dealing with... You don't rely on miracles in that way. So while the Jews were in the desert, they didn't circumcise themselves, which is one of the reasons why they didn't bring the Passover sacrifice. Because the Passover sacrifice, the Torah specifically instructs, can only be eaten by circumcised males. So because they didn't circumcise themselves, they couldn't bring the sacrifice. It's one opinion anyway. So what happened is, in preparation for bringing the Passover sacrifice, and because they hadn't been circumcised, they circumcised themselves. So, but this was only after they got into the land, when they finished their travels, so to speak. They went into the land, circumcised themselves, brought the Passover sacrifice, then they were ready for battle.
So I thought the timeline I heard you say was a 3-day period, and we read previously that 3 days is the third day is not the time you want to be going into battle after circumcision.
I believe, again, we're going to get to this, but I believe they went to battle on Pesach. On the first day of Pesach is when they started surrounding the walls. So remember, if they went in on the 10th of Nisan, let's say that they circumcise on the 11th, right? Then they have 3 days recovery. 14th of Nisan, they bring the Passover sacrifice, and they celebrate the Seder that night, and then the next morning, they begin their journey into Jericho. It's a busy time. Lots going on in those 2 weeks. All right. Brings us to chapter 2. So this is a juicy one. So Joshua sends these two men. They don't tell us who they are. Torah doesn't tell us who they are. It just calls them meraglim, which usually is translated as spies. Cheresh means secretly. Lamar, and he gives them instruction. If everybody would like to look in the first verse of chapter 2. Here, you can look into that. First verse of chapter 2, because I'm going to refer to a number of things in this verse. You can share. I'll read the verse and translate it. Vayishlach Yehoshua ben Nun, Joshua the son of Nun, sent min Hashitim, from the place called Shittim, Shnayim Anashim Miraglim, two men who were spies, Cheresh, secretly, Lamar, saying, Lechu re'u es ha'aretz, go and observe the land, the Es Yericho, and Jericho. Vayechu, and they went, Vayevayu, and they came, Beis Isha Zayna, to the house of a woman. I'm just going to use the Hebrew word Zona for right now. Ushma Rachav, and her name is Rachav. Vayishkevu Shama, and they slept there. Okay? So, the king finds out that these two men had arrived, and he sends messengers to the house, and he heard that they came and that they were spies. They came to spy the land. So he sends messengers to Rachav, and they say, give us these people. They're criminals. They're spies. So she took the two men and she hid them, and then she tells the person at the gate, at the door, I don't know, they were here and they left. I don't know who they are. I don't know where they came from. She had sent the men out. She said that as it was getting dark, the men left, and I don't know where they went. They must have run to the hills. Go chase after them. You can still catch up with them. Really, she brought them up onto the roof. She hid them underneath the flax that were there drying on the roof. And the soldiers chased after the men over the Jordan. And in the meantime, she comes back to the men, and she says to them the following: I know that Hashem, that God has given the land into your hands, and that the fear of you is upon the people of the land, and that the hearts of all the inhabitants of the land has melted. Because we have heard that which God did with the splitting of the sea and the battles against the two kings, Sihon and Og. And we have all heard, and our hearts are melted, and no one has the spirit to rise up against you. Because it's clear that, listen to these words, because it's clear that Hashem Elokeichem, Hashem your God, He is the God in the heavens above and on the earth below. And now, take an oath to me, since I've done you kindness and hid you in my house, do a kindness to me, and when you guys come in and you conquer the land, that you're going to let me, you're going to, me and my family live. And the men promise her that, and they instruct her to hang a string from her window so that they'll know which house is hers when they come into battle. She lets them out the window, and they head back through the mountainside. And they instruct her that as long as you put the rope in your window, you and your household, your family, your father's household will be saved. But if you don't put it there, it's on you. And she promised, and they left, and they return back to Joshua. Return back to Joshua, they instruct, they repeat everything that had happened, and they express confidence that the Jewish people would be victorious, and that the people of the land were frightened from the arrival of the Jews. So, let's go back to that first verse and understand a lot of things about this chapter just from understanding this first verse. So, first of all, who are these people? And why are their names not mentioned? The names are not mentioned explicitly because the question was, how is this journey going to, how is this spying going to evolve? Was it going to be successful? Was it not going to be successful? When Moses sent the spies, the agenda of the spies, as Moses told them, is go and spy out the land. In Hebrew, lasur, latur es haaretz. Go and spy out the land. What does Joshua say here? Luchu re'u es haaretz. Go and see the land. There's a big difference. What's the difference between spying out the land and seeing the land? Why would you spy a land, and why would you see a land?
Well, see the land, this spy means you don't possess it. To me, if you say see the land, I mean, this is, you're now in the process of taking possession.
It could mean the same thing.
It could mean the same thing, but yet the Torah uses two different expressions. So think about a spy. What is a spy trying to do?
Get information.
Get information. Does the spy know that they're going to be, sometimes that information comes back and says, you know what, maybe it's not a good idea, right? You send a spy, the spy figures out what the situation is, and they say, look, you know, I figured, I have information, and this is not a good idea. We're not going to win this one, you know, or it's going to cost too many lives, or whatever it is, right? And if you remember what Moses said to them, he said, go and find out, are they in fortified cities, or are they weak cities, are they, you know, bring back from the fruit of the land. He wanted to know what was going on there. Now, even though Moses had full confidence in God's ability, so his words could be taken out of context, the spies then took it out of context because they had a different agenda. Their agenda was, well, if they're in fortified cities, or if they're in weak cities, or if they're big and powerful, then maybe we shouldn't be doing this. And that's why they came back and they said, we shouldn't be doing this. They're too powerful for us. Joshua didn't say that. He didn't say, go and spy out the land. He said, go and see the land. And by the way, where did the spies go? Do you remember where they went? Where did they spy in the land?
I'm trying to remember. It was because they saw the giants and they saw the grapes. And
it was what? Jericho?
La'arka ul'rachba. Its length and its width. They traveled the whole land. What does he say here? He says, go and spy out, go and see the land and Jericho. You know where they went? To Jericho. They didn't go to the rest of the land. They only went to Jericho. Because Jericho, Yericho, was known in Hebrew as Min'ol Shel Ha'aretz. It was the lock, the bolt of the land. It's the strongest part of the land. If you can conquer Jericho, you got the rest of the land down. And that's why they started with Jericho, to show that they were going to be victorious in conquering Jericho in a miraculous way. So learn the lesson. The rest of it's going to happen the same way. But they were sent simply to see, to observe, which we'll talk about more in a moment. But one of the reasons that the spies' names are not mentioned is because where do they spend the night? Or whose house do they go to? They went, which house? They went to the house of Rachav, who is a Zona. Now Zona, anybody know what a Zona is? You don't want to tell an Israeli that he's a Zona, because they will punch you in the face. Or they actually use a different term. They called it a Ben Zona. But anyway. now you know what I'm talking about? Okay. So that's what they, but that, it's a neutral Hebrew word. I mean, it's a woman of the night, a harlot. Now the word zona, however, you know, there's a blessing borei minei mizonos, right? That's a different word. It means food. And you could simply read the verse that she ran an inn where she provided food for the passerbys. So it could be that's all she provided for the passerbys, but it could also be that she provided other things for the passerbys. And according to that opinion, not only did she provide that for the passerbys, but she provided that for all the many kings and noblemen who lived. She was the go-to... Thank you. She was the go-to person for all of the great nobles of Israel of the time, of Canaan. Let's not call it Israel. People of Canaan of the time. But one of the side benefits of being a Zona is that if you have all the nobles of the land coming to visit you, you also have a lot of pillow talk. And you know a lot of information. So if you want information, you go to the people that have it. That's why they went there. But it still doesn't look nice. Still doesn't look nice. So the Torah says, look, they had a mission to accomplish and they did it, but we don't have to spell out who they were, and that's where they who they were hanging out with. But their names are alluded to in the verses. Miraglim Cheresh Lamar. Cheresh means silent. When the spies went into Israel, there were two spies that returned and came back with a positive report. One was Joshua, and one was Kalev. The Torah tells us, Vayahas Kalev es ha'am. Caleb, silenced the people. Anybody remember how he silenced the people? Think about a mob. How do you get the mob quiet? Or how do you get the mob to pay attention to you? They got to think you're on their side, right? They think you're on their side, they're ready to get on board. So Caleb got up in front of the people and he says, you think this is all the son of Amram did for us? So people thought he was going to launch into a negative tirade against Moses. He says, he split the sea, he brought the manna down, he battled against the Amalek. So he silenced the people. And that's alluded to in the word cheresh, silent. He's the one, he's Caleb. Now, lamar means to say. We're talking about somebody who's a speaker. Who's the speaker? This is Pinchas. Who was Pinchas? Remember Pinchas? What did Pinchas do? With the spear. He became a warrior. He killed Zimri. And he became what's known as the priest of war. So there's a Meshuach Milchama. There is an anointed one of war whose job is to instruct the people as they are about to go out to war. The Torah tells us that it's the job of the Meshuach Milchama to warn the people. We're going out to battle. We're going to do God's will. God's going to be with us. Strengthen yourselves. Focus. You know, if you've planted a vineyard and you didn't harvest, go home. And if you married and if you betrothed but didn't marry, go home and so on. That's the job of the Meshuach Milchama, the anointed one of war, the priest of war. That is Pinchas, who's alluded to as the speaker who speaks. Now, a couple of interesting things about their mission here. What was their mission? So mission number one was in order to lift the spirits of the people. Knowing, as Joshua believed, that the fear of God, so to speak, was now upon the people of the land, what better report to come back with than to say, hey, guys, I know you're all nervous, I know we're doing this with a lot of faith, but you need to know the people are shaking in their boots. They are frightened. So that was mission number one, to bring back this report. Mission number two was not to decide if they can go into the land, but how they were going to approach it, as we mentioned earlier. And mission number three was to actually trick the Canaanites. How were they going to trick the Canaanites? Because the Canaanites, knowing that these spies came into the land, what do they now think about the Jews? They think they're coming to spy, not to see. Meaning the Jews are afraid of this battle. So if they're afraid of this battle, maybe they're not going to be well prepared. Maybe they're not that strong. Maybe they don't have enough self-confidence. So therefore, we could be a little bit more lackadaisical about how we prepare for battle. So it was actually a strategy of war in order to trick the enemy, that the enemy shouldn't be so haughty and think that they're set to go. So for the last minutes that we have left, I want to give you a beautiful, profound insight into drawing the distinction between the spies of Moses and the spies of Joshua. But first, let me just take any questions that anybody has on what we spoke about thus far.
I just have a question because my Hebrew is so...
It's a work in progress.
So
the next word is Lamor.
Yeah, where did I see it?
It's the first verse.
So I see that, and I'm just curious as to the best translation. In other words, the context of
sure.
The Karis, because it doesn't
secretly.
Say, where does it say that? Oh, secretly saying. Okay.
Secretly, and Lamor, he translates it here as ordered them. How does he translate it there? Read the verse. Go earlier on. Read it from the very beginning.
Oh, Joshua the son of Nun dispatched two men, spies from Shittim, secretly saying, go.
Okay, secretly saying. The saying is the...
Oh, so it's the two words.
It's the two words.
Secretly
and saying. Secretly
okay,
refers to Caleb, and saying refers to Pinchas.
Okay. All right. There you go. Okay. That's cool.
Any other questions? Okay. So, distinctions between... Joshua's spies and Moses' spies. Three distinctions. Two of them I already told you. Tell me what they are.
Names. Spying versus...
Okay, besides... Say it again.
Spying versus...
Okay, I told you two other ones besides that one.
Okay.
Two of them are obvious. The first one is obvious.
One is going to spy and the other is going to...
Besides that one. That's an extra... That's putting... That's icing on
the
whole
land and the other saw.
One's the whole land and one's just Jericho.
Right, okay.
Okay, that's one. What's the other very obvious distinction? Think.
See.
It's a very technical distinction.
The number of spies.
Number of spies. Moses sent 12. Joshua sent 2. Or essentially, Moses sent, or of the 12 spies, 10 of them were not so good, right? 2 of them were good. And the third distinction... I'm just trying to remember if that second distinction was a factor. It may not be.
So 12 or 2, spying versus
seeing. Yeah, spying versus seeing, and all of Israel versus just Jericho. And then the final one is where Moses does not receive God's command to send the spies. Moses sends the spies on his own. He has God's permission, but as the verse says, shlach lecha, send for yourself. And as Rashi comments there, I'm not commanding you to do it. You want to do it, do it, but I'm not commanding you. Whereas Joshua's sending of spies is with God's blessing and essentially with God's instruction via Joshua to send these spies. So what's going on here? And as we mentioned in the last class, these are not just stories for the sake of stories, but they're history with relevant messages for us in our time. So, the word Yericho, Jericho, first of all, at its root, it comes from the word Reach, or Ruach, which means?
Spirit
or? Breath. Or breath or smell. Reach means smell. It comes from the same root, because a smell is kind of like a spirit, right? Yericho was so called because of a particular tree or something that grew there that it had a good odor. But it also represents something else. How many nations lived in Israel?
70.
You're talking about the Jewish. I mean, you're talking about
no. How many primary nations lived in Israel before the Jewish people came to the land?
10.
Very good. 10. We know 7 of them were conquered. We say them in the prayers every day. The Charisim Ayarbis, the Seser, it's Aknani, the Chiti, Amori, Aprizi, Yevusi, Girgashi. I'm missing one. But they're there somewhere. And then there were 3 more, the Keni, the Knizi, Kadmoni. These 3 nations were not conquered at the time, and they represent a future era when they're going to be conquered. Moses' spies represent one dimension of service of God. Joshua's spies represent a different dimension of service of God. The service of God demonstrated, represented by Moses' spies, is not something that's a guarantee in our service. It's not necessarily a sure thing. And that's why God didn't command Moses to send spies. Moses sent them on his own. Moses has the ability to empower us to be successful at that journey. But it's not a sustainable journey for all people for all time. Joshua's spies are something that is available for all people and all time. And because it's available for all people for all time, that's why God commands Joshua to do it. And that's why Joshua does it. And I know I'm not putting all the pieces yet together, but I want to set the stage for you. It's also because Moses, the service of God represented by Moses' spies, is not something that that is not doable necessarily for all people for all time. It's also why they traversed the entire land, meaning all 10 nations. Whereas in the case of Joshua, because it is something that's doable for all people for all time, that's why they went only to Jericho, only to Yericho. Now, what are we talking about here? What's the distinction between these two things? So we know something that's known as the power of the souls, of the soul. And we have the garments of the soul. Power of the soul are the 10 sephiros, the 10 characteristics of the person. The chachma, bina, das, wisdom, understanding, knowledge. The 7 emotional traits, kindness, discipline, compassion. Endurance, humility, bonding, and nobility. What are the garments of the soul? Thought, speech, and action. A person does not necessarily have the ability to change who they are. It's not a sure thing. You could be a person who's stingy, and you can work all of your life to becoming a generous person, and you will be unsuccessful. You could be a person who's quick to anger, and you could spend your entire life trying to become slow to anger, and you won't be successful. You could be a person who has a profound ability to come up with great insights, but never develop the ability to take those insights and develop them into real ideas. You could be a person who's very compassionate, but very inconsistent. These are all internal characteristics. You may be a person who will be stingy your whole life, but you can always act generously. You can always talk generously. You can always choose to think generously. You could be a person who's tempted by any particular temptation, neutral or forbidden, and you may be susceptible to that temptation your entire life. And you may never be able to overcome the natural tendency for that temptation. But you always have the ability to use your mind to think about something else or to think about conquering that temptation. You can always use your mouth to control the temptation if it plays out in the mouth. And you always have your actions to control the outcome of that temptation. In other words, you never have to give in to that temptation in actuality, which, as we've discussed and as we know this idea as a fundamental principle of Jewish thought, which is in distinction to many other faiths, particularly as elaborated by Hasidic philosophy, and that is that the definition of a person's character is not who they are, but how they think, how they speak, and how they act. Why is that the definition of a person's character? Because that's the only thing you have control over. So if you find yourself tempted by something, that's natural. If you act on it, or you nurture the temptation with your thinking, let alone speaking about it, let alone acting on it, that's on you. That's a choice you've made. But who that person is, who you are, is a combination of things that are completely out of your control. Now, one should not despair that there's no hope, because there is hope. Sometimes all God is waiting for you to do is to work real hard at it. And if you do it over and over again, constantly conquering your temptation, then maybe you will arrive at a place where you've actually changed the way you feel about things. There's no guarantee, but it's very possible and maybe even likely that you can arrive at such a destination. Or as the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, that it's possible that a spirit will go up to God and God will evoke compassion on you. And even if you weren't lined up to have this particular dimension of your character transformed, you'll be successful at having it transformed. But again, there's no guarantee. And that's what Moses and his spies represented. They represented the travel to all of the land, all of the 10 nations of the land. Because the 10 nations of the land represent the inner character, the 10 powers of the soul, the 10 dimensions of a person. And God is saying, I can't command you to do this because there's no guarantee. We can't, it's not an eternal commandment. Right? What is the idea of spying? The idea of spying is to navigate and to dissect and try to understand how can I change who I am? How can I pull on the positive resources to conquer the negative resources? Or like you said, to gather information. What's the information that I need in order? God says, look, there's no guarantee that you're going to do all of this study. You're going to get all this information and you're going to walk out of here and suddenly become a different person inside. No guarantee. So therefore, God says, I can't command this. You on your own, you want to command it? That's your thing. However, to command people to control their thoughts, control their speech, and to control their action, that is in the ability of God to command us, because that's in the power we have, each of us have that power to master that behavior. And therefore, God says to Joshua, send these spies. Where do you need to send them? You only need to send them to Jericho. Because Jericho, the smell, represents the garments of the soul. It's the part that gets manifest to the other. How you think will translate down into your speech, into your action. That's what gets manifest. So that's the smell, so to speak. The odor that comes out of us is in these three dimensions, in the garments of the soul. And if we recognize that we have the ability to conquer that, then everything else follows from there. That's the battle that we can wage for all time. That's the struggle that we can actually conquer over. And that's why Joshua sends spies and he sends them to Jericho.
And why two spies?
I'm trying to remember that now. I'm trying to remember the reason for the two versus the 10 or the 12. I'm not remembering right now that particular point. Right.
Maybe it has something to do with that.
Could be. I'm going to look up in the discourse where I read this insight and see if there's a specific point about that.
Two versus 12.
Yeah.
Well, two at least mean two witnesses.
Yeah, could be. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities. I don't want to guess. I want to try to remember if there was a specific point that was made about the connection between these ideas. But fundamentally, that's the distinction between. Reach.
Mm-hmm. And if you could just repeat again this idea of the smell, the reach of, you know, the smell of Jericho. If you could put that within the context again of
garments. So when you meet someone and they smile to you and they say, "Good morning, how are you?" Or they come into the office and they bring you a cup of coffee. Do you know who they really are? You have no clue. You don't know if they're a nasty person or a nice person. You don't know if they are two-faced with you and they're just putting on a show. But how do we judge people? We judge people by how they come across to us. Because frankly, that's all the basis for why we should judge people. Right? How do you act? How do you treat people? You treat people well? I don't care if you're a nasty person inside. It's not important. It's your problem. It's not anybody else's problem. You're a stingy person, but you give generously? That's what's relevant. Yes, we're sorry you have a struggle. And we wish your struggle go away. But that might be your struggle. Who you are is not how you act. So your smell, just like a smell, right? Not to get too right. Crass, right? But you can, I remember once in yeshiva, one of the older students said something like, you know, "I'm going to go take an instant shower and take out Vada deodorant and, you know, spray his body. It's an instant shower, right?" Right? So what does that mean? You smell good now. Do we know that you're clean? No, you're not necessarily clean, but no one's going to find out because you smell good, right? When a person smells bad, they actually might be clean. They just may have some bad body odor, but they smell bad, so you assume that they're just not clean, right? The smell is a manifestation of who we are. Our actions, how we speak. Thought is a much more refined garment. But it directly translates down. And there's a dimension of the garment of thought that affects us outside of our panimiyut, outside of our inner dimensions, because it is something that we have control over. Interesting enough, there is the damage that's caused to the garments in many ways is much more damaging when we use our thoughts in a negative way than our speech. Speech is next damaging, and action is less damaging. Action is the least damaging on a spiritual level. On a physical level, the action is the most damaging. The speech is secondary. Thoughts are least damaging.
Yeah, I think we studied something like that regarding the commandment, one of the Ten Commandments, regarding lust, that it's actually the thought that is even more damaging.
Right. Think about it, a garment, right? If you have a silk garment and you spill something on it, it's going to be more damaged than if you have a burlap garment and you spill something on it, right? So thought is much more refined. So it's and think about how it affects us. A person who has negative thinking their negative thinking controls how they speak, controls how they act. A person who has positive thinking sometimes may act in a negative way, but there's an easier recovery from that. But the point is that smell is the manifestation of it's actionable items, even if the action is a thinking action, but it's actionable items that we have the ability to choose to change. Now, what's interesting is that you can close your mouth and you can tie your hands behind your back, but you can't turn your brain off. You can't turn your thinking off. But what you can do is think about something else. So we can always choose to think about something else. We can't turn our thinking off, but we can choose to think about something else. So the Rebbe would often answer people who would write to the Rebbe about negative thinking. Is two answers. One time the answer, I mentioned this in Shul a number of months ago, a beautiful letter about the anxiety that the Rebbe has about that, that when a person strengthens their belief in divine providence, anxiety goes away. Because anxiety comes from trying to control the outcome, and when you have faith that the outcome is controlled by God, you have less anxiety. But sometimes people are not receptive at a particular stage to investing their thinking in healthy thinking. So the Rebbe's instruction oftentimes was Hesach Hadas. Hesach Hadas means simply redirect your thinking. Or that's not right. That's not actually a good translation. Hesach Hadas means stop thinking about it. There's this great video that's going around from an old comedy where this person comes to the therapist and tells the therapist, you know, I have OCD. So the therapist says two words, that's all I need. Stop it. That's it. Just stop it, right? So sometimes some people just need stop it. Sometimes people are receptive to thinking more deeply about other things, and sometimes they're not in a position to do that. So the stopping it sometimes can't be about turning off your brain, but it's, okay, don't think about it. Think about something else. Invest your thinking in something else. Obviously, people who struggle with that in a deep way, in a clinical way, it's very, very difficult for them. But it's the same fundamental principle. You have a temptation. I'm sorry you have a temptation. It doesn't mean you need to act on it. It doesn't. It just because you have temptation doesn't mean you need to act on it. Just because you struggle with something doesn't give you license to act on it. Everybody's got different temptations. And again, I'm not talking about addictions, which is its own complex. I'm talking about everything outside of disease, right? We all struggle. Some struggle more than others. Some struggle in certain areas more than others. But it's all at the end of the day. The manifestation of the struggle translates down into how we think, how we speak, and how we act. That is in our power. Who we are, that's not in our power. We can't change that. There's no guarantee that you're going to change that. You can try. Sometimes you get lucky, but there's no guarantee. Good?
Yeah, I'm just trying to digest the comparison of Moses sending the spies versus Joshua, and I think it's a lot to chew on to try to, you know, internalize and make and owning
right.
that information. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. As it turns out, so the lock, remember the lock on the door of Israel is Jericho, right? Because if you come to recognize this dimension, then you're empowered, you're in control.
Yep, that was the piece. That's what I needed. Thank you. That's exactly
what I needed.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember seeing anything on that specifically. But let me look that up for next time.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. What was the first one? Remind me.
The first one was the significance of the two.
The two verses, yeah.
And then she is a lady of night, you know. So,
that was her Kabbalah, sorry.
One of the commentaries tell us here that it was the very rope that she used to let them out the window. So that was to be the symbolism of the oath. And that's on a basic level. But I'm going to look into that, see if there's something more to add to that. All right?
Yes, that bolt of the land was what I needed.
It was a bolt of lightning. Yes, next week is December 25th, and then January 1.
I forget, is there a reason why we can't study it on the 25th?
That was a mitzvah, study on the 25th.
No. No. Well, so first of all, I think it's